You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Masha Gessen is a pioneering Russian journalist who has bravely, and I mean really bravely, chronicled her country's tradition of dissidents from the Russian Revolution into the present movement. Doesn't mean she was living in the Russian Revolution, but her work covers often that span of time. She was born in Moscow and came to the United States when she was 14. And 10 years later, she returned to Russia, where she became a prominent journalist covering the war in Chechnya, as well as becoming an outspoken advocate for LGBT rights. Writing in both Russian and English, she has covered every major development in Russian politics and culture of the past two decades, receiving numerous awards and fellowships in the process. She blogs weekly for the New York Times. She has written for numerous publications and has also edited several Russian magazines. Recently, she has relocated back to the United States. She's the author of many books, among them the bestseller Perfect Rigor, A Genius and the Mathematical Breakthrough of the Century. Masha also knows her math, a biography of a brilliant, young, eccentric Russian mathematician who solved the famous Poincaré conjecture in 2006. There is her memoir, Esther and Ruzia, How My Grandmothers Survived Hitler's War and Stalin's Peace. Though it's a memoir, it reads like a novel, and it offers a brilliant vision of Russian history from Stalinism through the fall of communism. In Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, the book that precedes her new book on Pussy Riot, she shows English-speaking readers how Putin became Putin, the story behind that man without a shirt, riding a horse, and leading Russia into a dark future. It reads like a thriller, but it is scarily true. Her newest book, which she'll discuss tonight with Susie Weissman, is Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. Masha Gessen is the perfect guide to lead us through the arrest, trial, and imprisonment of the three Pussy Riot members who were sentenced in Russia to 2 years in a penal colony for the charge of hooliganism, and who, since their release, have become human rights activists on the world stage. Putin's nightmare. Gessen takes us behind the scenes to help us understand the forces that transformed a group of young women into artists with a shared vision and, as Gessen wrote of her own grandmothers, with burden of a conscience. As Maria Alyokhina, one of the three Pussy Riot activists, bravely reminded the court during her final statement, quote, "All you can do is take away my so-called freedom, the only sort that exists in the Russian Federation, but no one can take away my inner freedom." Susie Weissman is a professor of politics at St. Mary's College of California. You probably know her from her weekly broadcast of Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman on KPFK Los Angeles. She serves on the editorial boards of Critique and Against the Current and is the author of Victor Serge, The Course Set on Hope, and the editor of Victor Serge, Russia 20 Years After and the Ideas of Victor Serge. Please join me in welcoming Masha Gessen and Susie Weissman to the LA Public Library.
Well, thank you all for coming. It's so nice to see a big crowd, and I'm sure a lot of you have a lot of good questions to ask Masha Gessen. We're very lucky to have her with us here tonight. And I wanted to just start with a little bit of the clip that we have. That's the second clip. Can we push that up, pull it up? It's hard to imagine what an impact those 40 seconds had. We're going to come back to that while we talk to Masha Gessen. Thanks for coming here tonight.
Thank you for having me.
And this book, which, as Louise said, is going to be available afterwards, Words Will Break Cement, it comes from a poem.
Actually, it comes from Nadia's closing statement in court, and in that she's quoting Solzhenitsyn.
That's
not a poem, prose, but...
Okay, and thank you. And but the publication of the book was accelerated because just before the Sochi Games, Putin gave amnesty to Katya and Nadia.
Nadia and Maria.
I'm sorry, Nadia Maria. It's okay. Thank you. After they had already served 650 days in jail, and as punishment for essentially that 40 seconds of a performance that really was truncated, and we're going to talk a lot about what went behind that, what their influences were, and everything else. So maybe we should start with what caused the Pussy Riot to form. Earlier, we were going to look at a clip, but decided not to, about showing the President Medvedev announcing with Putin that they were going to essentially swap jobs and that Putin would then become president. What happened?
For the third time.
For the third time. What happened after that?
Well, there actually isn't a direct relationship between those two events. A lot of people in Russia felt absolutely despondent when Putin and Medvedev came out during a congress of the ruling United Russia Party, and in something that was extremely reminiscent of the Soviet Party congresses, sort of said, okay, we have decided that you all should support Putin for president. And then there was thunderous applause of tens of thousands of hands. And it was decided that Putin was president, even though there had been no election. And then there was a parliamentary election in December, so 3 months later. It was a sham election, just like every election before it had been for years. And then there would be another election that was the presidential election. And right after the parliamentary election, the Russian protest movement that I'm sure everybody knows about broke out quite suddenly for everyone else. But Pussy Riot at that point had already existed for a couple of months. It was born as a fiction. It was born when Nadia, who was a philosophy student at Moscow University, 21 years old, and had participated in another protest art group called Vaina, she was asked to speak at a conference of opposition activists. And mostly this was because there were so few opposition activists that when one of the opposition activists noticed somebody else who was kind of charismatic and participating in these tiny little opposition events that were happening, they would sort of sometimes try to draw them in. So Nadia was asked to give a presentation. She decided she was going to give a presentation on feminist art. And because she was very taken with it, she was reading about all this radical feminist art in the West. And so she put together what could really be a freshman course on feminist art. But freshman courses in feminist art are not taught in Russia. So she sort of put it all together in an hour and a half long presentation. But there was a problem with the presentation, which was that there were no Russian artists. And there was one, but one is not enough. And she was very commercial, and she'd been working for a long time. And Nadia felt she needed to finish with a Russian artist. I mean, otherwise it was kind of wrong at an opposition activist conference to talk about Western artists all the time. So she made one up. She made up a group called Pisya Riot. And Pisya is a Russian word for, it's a childish word for genitals. It's like wee-wee riot, right? So this was like this incredible group. This was a very versatile group. They did visual art. They did renderings of classic paintings with laundry and dirty dishes superimposed on them, as feminist symbols. And they did punk rock, which was a little difficult because neither Nadia nor Katya, who was helping her with the presentation, was a musician or knew much about music. So they took a song by the Cockney Rebels, which is a British punk group from the 80s. And they wrote lyrics that a Russian punk group would sing if a feminist Russian punk group existed. And which was like a caricature of feminist lyrics. So it started with Stinky Socks, and it ended with the brilliant line, "Envy your own fucking penis." And they recorded this on a dictaphone at a playground because they needed some place where they could sort of jump around and scream this. They didn't have enough time, enough space in a home to do this. So they went out to a children's playground in the evening when there were no children there to record it. The thing is that there were no children, but there were young people sitting around drinking beer. And the young people got really concerned, and they went up to them and said, you know, did something happen to you? Did someone hurt you? Like, do you need help? Do I need to go beat him up? And they shooed them away, and they kept recording. So at this presentation, Niza finished with the words, and amazingly, there's a feminist punk rock group working in Nizhny Novgorod right now, and we're going to leave you with a song of theirs. And then she pressed a button on the boombox, and then this absolute awfulness came out. It was like a thousand rusty nails and women screaming, and they walked out of the room. And I wasn't there. I actually watched this on videotape. So the camera followed them out of the room, and you could see all these faces. There were about 40 men in the room and no women. And all these men looked like they didn't know what hit them and what they were supposed to do. Like, could they get up and turn off the music, or did they have to wait for the women to come back? And unfortunately, I don't know what happened, because the operator walked out of the room.
Was this the beginning of their adopting this form of kind of shock art music slash as a form of protest? And you mentioned that there were about 40 men in the room. And so do you know what how they reacted and who they were, what age group they represented?
There were mostly men in their 30s and 40s. Aside from absolute shock, I don't know how else they reacted. Both Nadia and Katya and some of the women who joined them right away after they decided that actually this was a really good idea and they wanted to make this a reality, they had participated in an earlier protest art group called Vaina. There are some significant differences between Pussy Riot, as it came to be called, as you know, and Vaina. One was that Pussy Riot is an anonymous collective. So Vaina was very personalized and very personified. And they had actually talked, when they were in Vaina, they had talked about anonymity as a principle and as a potential sort of tool of art making. But they'd never done it. They decided to do it with Pussy Riot. And they decided that, well, obviously, to be anonymous, you had to somehow hide your faces, right? So that's where the balaclava came from. Because originally, when they talked about it in Vaina, they talked about black ski masks that Russian SWAT teams wear. But they're really frightening, so they decided they would wear these neon balaclavas, and then they came up with the dresses and the tights that would go, they would be miscoordinated with the balaclavas to be punk, and with the garish makeup that they would be wearing, so you could see the makeup through the eye slits and the mouth slit in the balaclava. And actually, I thought it was very strange when I was first told that they were wearing makeup, but it is noticeable. Among the principles of Pussy Riot was that, again, it's anonymous, it's open membership, so anybody can be Pussy Riot. You put on a balaclava, you're Pussy Riot. You take it off, you're not Pussy Riot. So as one of the participants later told me, it's like being Spider-Man. Their finished product would be the video clip, so it's not the performance. They don't actually perform for audiences. And they decided that they would do all of their performances as series of performances, and the video clip would be a compilation of those series. It didn't always work out, but their first couple of performances were done that way. And another thing that distinguished them from Vaina was that Vaina was always overladen with symbolism and very obscure in its presentation.
And you should say that it means war.
Yes, Vaina means war.
So, I mean, you go from sort of, and I don't want to interrupt you, but from Pussy Riot, Vaina, and Pussy Riot. What connection is there?
I wouldn't put too much significance on the names. I think they said they were chosen because they sound good. So they decided that the Pussy Riot video clips would be accompanied by very clear explications. So they would post them online, and they would write very accessible texts on what they meant to say and why they said it the way they said it.
So to get back then to, there's so many different aspects that I want to explore, and I hope we have time to do it. One, you started to talk about some of their influences, and for example, some of the other artists, but what other cultural and artistic influences, especially with Nadia, who had a very unusual childhood growing up mostly in Siberia, Norilsk, and who decided to study art, had a very interesting father. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about who these three principal women are that you chose to write about most in the book, and then we can go and see how they relate to the movement.
Right. Yeah, I wrote about, the main characters in the book are three women who were unmasked and tried as Pussy Riot. I would say that the mastermind behind Pussy Riot was Nadia. Katya, or Kat, was very much by her side as they were sort of coming up with the idea. Maria Alekhina, who has become absolutely central to the whole Pussy Riot case and the Pussy Riot cause, she had taken part in some Vaina actions, but she wasn't central to conceptualizing Pussy Riot.
She was more an environmentalist, wasn't
she? An environmental activist, yeah. So their stories are... I was fascinated with how something like that comes to be, because there's nothing in Russia that would suggest that a Pussy Riot could exist. And in fact, as I said, there are no radical feminist artists or non-radical feminist artists working in Russia. I mean, there wasn't sort of the soup from which something like this could appear. And so I was trying to figure out where Nadia with her ideas came from, and I didn't figure out that much. She shouldn't exist, but she does. But we had a long correspondence while she was in prison about her intellectual influences and her self-education program. She was born in Siberia. She grew up mostly in Norilsk. Norilsk is the farthest north city with a population of over 100,000. And if that doesn't sort of conjure an image, just imagine black. Imagine a city that is dark most of the year because of polar night. And then when it's polar day, you see just how hideous it is, because it's a heavy metals industry. It's got a very mineral rich soil. So because of the soil and because of the industry, there are all these metal particles in the air. So it's the air is kind of black, and the soil is black, and there's just this city of darkness and starkness. And her father, who left the family very early on, and self-identifies as an artist, which I think in his case kind of means he doesn't do much of anything. He told me that when she came to Moscow, or they went to the south of Russia together in the summers. Once she came to Moscow, he said, and she saw a duck in a channel in Moscow. Now Moscow, if you can sort of visualize Moscow, is not the most nature-rich city in the world, but there is a little bit of water and there are a few ducks. And so Nadia saw a duck and she said, "Is it real?"
Wow.
And he was really struck by this because he said to me, "You know, she didn't say that's a duck." Her first assumption was that a thing like that couldn't be real. I mean, she wasn't used to seeing live nature, right? So her question was, is it real? But what also struck me about that conversation that I had with her father was that he would notice something like that and sort of, you know, register it in his mind. And in that sense, he was an incredibly constructive and productive influence on her. He was the person who contradicted her mother in every way and probably made her life hell, the mother's, I mean. But he also, for the little girl, he opened up the world to her. He would talk to her about art and literature, and he would give her things to read, and he would show her stuff, and he would explain to her that this was this architectural style and this was that architectural style. And she's still very, very grateful to him for doing all of that and for sort of showing her that the world was complicated and that there was a lot of art in it. And back in Norilsk, she was very disappointed with everything that surrounded her in Norilsk. At the age of 14, she wrote an article for the local newspaper, which is called «Заполярная правда», the truth beyond the polar circle, the Arctic circle, in which she criticized the school and the education system in Norilsk and her peers, who were not interested in anything and weren't getting a good education, didn't want a good education. And finished it with counterintuitively by saying that things will get better. And I have to say that finding that really turgidly written article was very reassuring for me, because at least I knew she didn't come out of the womb spouting theory, which I kind of began to suspect at some point. But no, she She was not a terribly well-educated or a very good writer as a teenager, but she was very motivated to get something better. So she created a curriculum for herself. She created her own syllabus of early 20th century Russian philosophers. So she was methodically working her way through them. And then something happened for her, which is that in the mid-1990s, a couple of Russian oligarchs bought the metals companies in Norilsk. And one of them, Mikhail Prokhorov, who some of you may have heard of, decided that he was going to transform Norilsk. And among other things, he created a foundation, an arts foundation. He put his older sister, whom he adores, and who is a leading Russian intellectual, he put her in charge of it. And he told her to bring culture to Norilsk. So every summer, she would get a whole bunch of Moscow writers and artists and photographers together, and she would airlift them into Norilsk for the brief Arctic day. And they would lecture and hold workshops and master classes. And Nadia went to see a poet named Dmitry Prigov. He's a Moscow conceptualist poet and visual artist and performance artist who's amazing. And that taught her that something else could exist in art as well. It was Moscow conceptualism, which was a movement that took Soviet language and Soviet bureaucracy and Soviet the stark Soviet visuals and made art out of them, instead of resisting them and sort of molded them. She saw that that was possible, was very taken with it, and started studying the Moscow conceptualists as well. So that's Nadia's intellectual biography. And she then got into the philosophy department at Moscow University, which disappointed her terribly. But then she got into conceptual art activism.
And Prigov played a very important role, too, for both Vina and Pussy Riot, too. When they maybe you can talk about the wake that they held in, the poem.
Yeah, I love that story, and I love the reaction. Nadia came to Moscow, started studying at the philosophy department. Within 6 months, realized that it was not what she wanted. It was boring and cookie cutter, and the aesthetics chair of the philosophy department thought that Andy Warhol was edgy and risky, and no one else in the philosophy department had ever heard of Andy Warhol. So at that point, she met an older man of 20 named Petya Verzilov, who was amazing. He was he'd lived in Canada, he'd gone to high school in Canada, he'd spent a year in Japan, he had seen Judith Butler speak in person.
This, by the way, just to interrupt, this is the most amazing thing when you read it, that for Nadia, you know, that this man, Petya, who she was to marry later, but that he had actually seen Judith Butler in Toronto University.
Right. Yeah, there's a funny footnote to that as well, but if we have time, we'll get to it. But anyway, so Peter was also very taken with Nadia. And basically it was because here was this beautiful creature. I mean, I'm sure you've all seen pictures of Nadia, and she is amazing looking. And then she opens her mouth and she starts talking about the Moscow conceptualists. And Peter has maybe met six people who've heard of the Moscow conceptualists. And so they start talking, and Peter tells her that he and a couple of his friends want to start a protest art group. And they didn't really have much of an idea of what it would be, except that it would make protest art. But what protest art would be, they hadn't figured out. So Nadia suggests that they go talk to Prigov. And the four of them, these two young couples, go talk to Prigov. And Prigov, of course, absolutely falls in love with them. So they decide to do an action together. And the action is going to be putting Prigov inside a fireproof safe and carrying him up 27 floors to the 27th floor of the main building of the Moscow University, right? Which is it's the highest point in Moscow. It's also supposed to be the pinnacle of enlightenment in Moscow because it's the top floor of Moscow University main building. It is also the place where the headquarters of the labor camp, the inmates of which built Moscow University, were located during the construction project. And it's, as all Vinaya actions, it's completely bursting with symbolism. So it's that, and then Prigov, who's stuck inside a fireproof safe, and these four philosophy students who are carrying up the stairs, and I don't know how they were planning to do that. I think they have no idea how much a fireproof safe weighs.
Someone in it.
and Prigov was going to recite a poem from inside the safe, and this was going to start a dialogue with the students, and so the action was going to be actually debating and being in dialogue with Prigov as they carried him up the stairs. So they planned this action. Prigov wrote the poem, and they were supposed to meet at a Moscow bookstore cafe. They hadn't been able to procure a fireproof safe. They decided to use a wooden armoire instead. and Prigov was late. He was 2 hours late. And so finally he called and said, it's a funny thing, but I seem to have had a heart attack on the way to meet you, and I'm in the hospital, and I'm in the ICU. So they go to see him in the ICU, and it's all very funny. And then a week later, he's dead. Yeah. And the last poem he ever wrote was the poem that was supposed to start the dialogue that never happened. So the first Vinaya action is actually my favorite action of theirs. It's the wake. They went into the Moscow metro, and they set up, if you can visualize a subway car, with seats that only go along the sides of the car, right? So
Facing each other.
Yeah. And they found these picnic tables, folding tables, that fit perfectly between these seats. So they went into the subway car and they threw down these picnic tables, and they put traditional wake fare on them, and including vodka and bitter and sweet food, and they sat down and they had a wake. And they did this on the ring line of the Moscow metro, which goes around in a circle. They actually went around like 1.5 revolutions before they were removed. They did it late when there was almost nobody there. But it's also pretty incredible, because to imagine that these days anybody could do something so bizarre and unsanctioned anywhere in a public space in Moscow is just absolutely impossible.
Can I read a little bit of this poem?
Please do.
I think it's amazing, and it really struck me a lot, and I'll tell you why. It says, "My ambition is serving..."
No, that's not the poem that he wrote. This is a poem... it's a great poem. I love this poem.
This is the one that, okay.
Yeah, but this is the poem that Prigov wrote as a young man and that they recited at his wake.
At the wake.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so not in the...
No, not in the Fireproof Safe. That other poem is a little bit earlier, but...
I'm just going to...
Yeah, please do. I love that poem. Yeah.
This one is, he says, "My ambition is serving as compost for the future, more rational sort. So a youth full of merit and purpose grows tall in my fertilized dirt. So a youth incorruptibly, proudly has disdained shady foreigners' pay, realizes all madness around him, yet declares, 'I love you, come what may.'" And, you know, this to me echoed a theme, I think, for many people who had perished because they criticized. You know, and I know of the left oppositionists and others in the 30s who also wrote that they would serve, Victor Serge said, "We'll serve as manure to fertilize the earth in which after us new human harvests will rise to bring forth
a revolution." Yeah, that's a clear reference to that, yeah.
It's a clear reference to that, and it sort of brings into this sort of new generation that came about that finally existed,
right,
and that could protest. Okay, so it's not the poem.
It's an early poem, but they chose it for the wake, and that's what made that action so poignant for me. You saw it on videotape. You saw them sitting there, and they really are absolutely heartbroken. And they're reciting this poem, and they know that they think that the poem was written for them. But they're having a conversation with Prigov that they can no longer have.
Right. So how does it go from there, from this first, these first actions, and then you get, and it started at a time before, as you say, before Putin announced that he was going to come back, or that Medvedev and Putin announced. They decide then to become Pussy Riot. And I guess the real question is what kind of politics they thought that they would represent and how they really saw the society around them. I know in many of the quotes that you bring forth, they talk about mediocrity and conformity and that people live their lives as automatons. But how developed would you say their critique was?
Well, considering that they existed for all of 4 months before they were arrested, it was pretty developed. It was largely borrowed from Western theory. I mean, I was actually struck in August of 2012 during the trial of Pussy Riot. I'd been covering the trial in Moscow, and then I came to New York for vacation, and I happened to be at the Ace Hotel at a reading of contemporary artists who were reading Pussy Riot texts on the day that they were being sentenced. And it was pretty amazing because a lot of these artists, I hadn't seen them in 20 years, and also I know that they hadn't thought of Russia in 20 years or ever. And all of a sudden, Pussy Riot had sort of drawn the attention of so many people to Russia who hadn't been paying attention, which I think is one of their many significant accomplishments. So there was somebody, I think it was Karen Finley, who was reading Nadia's closing statement in court. And I thought, wow, this actually sounds better in English than it does in Russian. Because in Russian, it sounds like it was translated from English. And in English, it sounds native, because they're so steeped in Western protest rhetoric. And it is all so strange to Russia. It's so new. They were so eager to sort of import it because there was the truth, and nobody in Russia was paying any attention to what was going on. But more specifically, to answer your question, I mean, Vojna split up because of interpersonal tensions a couple of years before Pussy Riot was born. So they were all sort of stumbling about trying to figure out what they were going to do next. And Nadia was reading a lot of feminist theory. And then it all sort of congealed into this idea of Pussy Riot. And it was going to be a feminist group, which to Nadia meant a lot. To most of the other young women who participated in it, it was a pretty vague idea. But it meant it was a girl group. And it meant they were independent. And they were fighting. And that's really sort of the extent of the theoretical foundation of feminism in the group. It was an anti-Putin group, that was very clear. And what made it very unusual for the Russian opposition, was that it was leftist. They didn't talk about being leftist, but their targets, they only did five actions before they were arrested. They've done a couple since. But their targets, their second target was consumerism of the Putin era. And they did their second clip, which was called Kropotkin Vodka, where Kropotkin is the Russian anarchist priest and prince. And vodka is vodka, and signifies consumerism. Yeah. No, it's not. They would get to the religious water later. But it signifies unbridled consumerism. And they recorded that in a series of guerrilla performances and fashion shows and boutiques and in the pedestrian mall where all these luxury boutiques are. And they accidentally set a fashion show on fire in the process.
So then, they never expected, did they, to have the kind of notoriety and certainly, what happened to them. But can you talk a little bit about what happened as the Moscow protest movement started to, show up? And then on the night that Putin was reelected or in that sort of power swap, they do their performance.
No, they were.
They do it a week later, actually, isn't it?
Yes. They. Putin claimed re-election in March. Medvedev and Putin announced that Putin was going to become president again in September, and then a week later, Nadia and Katya invented Pussy Riot. They didn't actually do an action for another month after that. But then, what happened was on December 4th, 2011. There was the parliamentary election, which was rigged like every election before it had been rigged for years. And there were some stalwart protesters who always scheduled protests and got permits, and 200 or 300 people would show up, and it was very depressing. It's particularly depressing, actually, because the way that protests work in Russia is pretty strange to anybody who comes from a democratic country. You have to get a permit for a particular place and a particular number of people, and then the police set up cordons so that the people protesting are inside these fenced off spaces, right? So they're only talking to one another. And even if it's a march, they close off the entire street, so you can't have any onlookers, right? So the sidewalks are empty, and then there are police barriers all along the street, and then you march in the street, and then you get to the place where you're going to have a rally, and that's also all cordoned off, et cetera. So, and to enter this cordoned off space, you have to pass through a metal detector. And you get there, and there are 200 or 300 people that you've seen a zillion times before, and you stand around for a while, and maybe somebody gives an uninspiring talk, and you leave. And Nadia and Katya pretty much always went, and Peter. And I have to say, I almost always went because I also felt like I had to. On the day after the election, I was going, and one of my best friends picked me up at home because it was near my house, and it was dark and it was raining. It was early December in Moscow. It was freezing. And I said, I really don't want to go. And he said, well, we have to, because who's going to go if we don't go? And then we got there, and like everybody was there. Everybody went. There were 10,000 people. And there were 6 metal detectors. And of course, people couldn't go through the 6 metal detectors. So people jumped the police cordon, and the police didn't do anything. And something was happening.
And you write, I mean, this was carried in the press here as a middle class protest, that finally people felt that, you know, they should have some say in who's going to lead the country, and that it shouldn't be told to them. But I think I was reading in some of your journalism, and you mentioned that this was a huge cross section of all ages. People, some who could afford to buy a car, which was important in Russia, but many who, you know, couldn't, were just barely making it. So it wasn't necessarily completely middle class. But would you say that this was the sort of awakening that we're seeing in the squares kind of around the world? Or is this something that's peculiarly Russian?
I'm really glad you asked that, because actually that example of the middle class protest is an example of really successful Kremlin propaganda. Because this was the label that the Kremlin immediately put on the protests. These are, they called them the irritated city dwellers. And they said that, you know, that they're just the middle class and they're just urban dwellers. Yeah. And American papers, you know, all of them immediately said, oh, it's the middle class protest and it's just the city dwellers. Yes, it's the city dwellers. It's an 80% urban country. 80% of Russians live in cities.
And Moscow is the largest city in Europe. People yes. often don't know that.
Yeah. But at there were, at the height of the protest movement, there were simultaneous protests in 99 different Russian cities and towns. So large cities, small towns, they were all coming out. And in fact, there was a pretty good study done of the Moscow protest, the largest protest, on December 24th, 2011. There was a sample of something like 10,000 people that they took out of the 100,000. And they came to the conclusion that, yeah, it was a total cross-section, so people of all income levels, slanted slightly toward higher educated, but the population of Moscow is slanted toward higher educated. Mm-hmm. A fair variety of political views. So, and actually, interestingly, they didn't. Only about half the people learned about the protest from the internet, and the other half learned by word of mouth, from the radio, from print newspapers. So, very, very, very different people. Is it fair to compare it to other movements? It's certainly fair to talk about the Arab Spring, because people in Russia were watching Arab Spring and feeling incredible envy, you know, that people could come out and change their fate. So in that sense, yes, it's there's a relationship. We didn't know a whole lot about Arab Spring. We didn't know, you know, other than the fact that it happened.
Toppled a dictator.
Yeah, and toppled a dictator, yeah. So, and it seemed like that's how it worked. People came out in the square and then, like, he was toppled. And there are a lot of things that are in play and that weren't in play in Russia. And one thing that probably has been underexamined is the tacit agreement between the protesters and the government about how the protests were conducted. That business of protesting inside the cordoned off area, of only protesting if they had a permit. There was a very small minority within that movement that objected to it, and Pussy Riot belonged to it. And part of what they were doing in church and part of what they were doing the month before that in Red Square was pushing the limits of that protest movement and challenging that tacit agreement.
So we should go back to that clip that we saw, because this leads right into a couple of months later to their actual performance here. And I want to talk about, you know, how this 40-second performance could bring down such repression. And so can we have that the second clip? So, Masha Gessen, can you explain what they were trying to do, what the words of the song that you can't really hear were? And, you know, we've seen repression has been very swift and very strong everywhere when we come to the kind of protest movement that we were talking about in the squares. But here it led to a show trial. So maybe we could start with what it was that they were doing, why they chose that cathedral.
Right. So this is February 21st, 2012. In 2 weeks, Putin will declare re-election to his third unconstitutional term in office. And he's faced with a mass protest movement. He's very nervous. So he drafts the Russian Orthodox Church to campaign for him. And this is what Russian dictators have always done, even during the Soviet period. In times of crisis, they've reached for the Russian Orthodox Church. This is something that most people in this country don't realize. It was always on hand, even in the Soviet period. And so he reaches for the Russian Orthodox Church, and the church starts campaigning for him. And the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church is comparing Putin to God. And the parish priests are directing believers not to attend protests, because Orthodox believers do not attend protests. And Pussy Riot decide to go into the Cathedral of Christ the Savior as the most official the cathedral where government members like to go on church holidays. This is where they're always filmed. It's a public display cathedral. It's where the patriarch officiates on church holidays, but not other times. And it's really where religion and power come together in Russia. It's also where corruption is on blatant display. It's the cathedral has a room that it rents out for events. It has a car wash in the cathedral, and it is home to some sort of the Cathedral of Christ the Savior Foundation, where a lot of money goes in and no money comes out. So it is all that. It is like it is the perfect symbol of Russia today. And the song that they wrote was called The Punk Prayer. It has two refrains. One is Mother of God, chase Putin out. Another one is Holy shit, holy shit, holy shit, which is what you hear them singing in that little bit. That is also the reason that why much of the television watching public in Russia firmly believes that they went into a church and defecated.
But you also say that the press was terrible and lied when they covered it.
Wait, let's separate the some press from other press. There's the state media, and at the time we still had a little bit of independent media. The independent media were terrific on their trial, but 98% of Russian households get state TV, and that's their main source of information. So as I said, the majority of Russians really do believe that Pussy Riot went into the church and defecated. So they didn't actually think that they were going to get arrested. And they had no reason to think they were going to get arrested. I mean, at that point, and this is very hard to believe now, 2 years ago, people weren't actually going to jail in Russia for peaceful protest. That wasn't a thing. We now understand that that's like a regular occurrence in Russia, and it is. But 2 years ago, that wasn't happening. people were getting maybe 10, 15 days administrative arrest, which is a very strong slap on the wrist, but it's a slap on the wrist if they were convicted of violating public assembly laws. Putin was going to begin a crackdown as soon as he came back into office. And this was the perfect place to start, because it's the perfect protest, because it shines a light on exactly what Russia is and exactly what's wrong with it. And it words it very well. And that is why a criminal case was launched against them a couple of days, actually, after the protest. During the protest, they were grabbed by security and removed from the cathedral, and that was it. Indeed, it was so sort of insignificant that they were removed, but their equipment was taken by police. So then they got together that evening, and they really wanted to get their equipment back. So they came up with this cockamamie story. A male friend of theirs went to the police and said that he had been approached by some women on the subway who had asked him to borrow some music equipment. And he produced a forged document showing that they'd borrowed his music equipment. And then they'd gone into the cathedral and done this, and the police had taken their equipment, but it's his equipment, and could he have it back, please? And he got it back.
But then they're arrested, and they are put on trial, and they're charged with hooliganism and inflicting moral damage on believers, which is a kind of strange charge secular...
No, they weren't charged with inflicting moral damage on believers.
In the trial proceedings.
That was what the testimony was about.
Yeah.
The charge was felony hooliganism. And felony hooliganism is defined in the law as a crude disturbance of the social order motivated by hatred for a particular social group. So they were basically convicted of a hate crime. And the social group that they supposedly attacked, they supposedly hated, were Orthodox believers. So, but you're right, the testimony in the trial centered on the moral damage that they inflicted. So there was a whole lineup of so-called victims who testified that they had been traumatized by either witnessing the performance or watching it on YouTube over and over again. And this had rendered them unable to work. It was the most difficult part, actually, of putting the book together was trying to get the trial into what I think it's like 60 pages in the book.
It's really the heart of it.
It's the heart of it, and there was no writing involved. It was just working with the audio and videotapes, and trying to figure out how I was going to not like make an encyclopedia out of it, because that's just what's in the book is really a day plus a little bit. But that was 9 days of nightmare for them. I'll give you a couple of examples of the kind of testimony that happened in the trial. So a witness says, and then they go up on the solius, which is the platform in front of the altar, and they start crossing themselves. And the judge says, well, did they cross themselves like regular Orthodox believers? And the one says, no, they did it kind of fast. Another witness says, and then they started jerking devilishly. And a defense attorney, and the defense attorneys were totally out of their depth, that a defense attorney says, I would like to know how the witness knows how the devil jerks. Has she seen the devil? And my favorite is, and it was hard to choose a favorite, but my favorite is this. A witness says, and they appeared possessed. And the judge says, I object. The witness does not have a medical degree and is not qualified to render a diagnosis of possession. This is 2012 in Europe. And it was actually, it's hilarious. It's also really scary. Because this was all done in absolute seriousness. And there are these three women who it was a prank. It was a brilliant prank, but it was a prank. And now it's 6 months later. They've been in jail for 6 months. They're in a cage, as you will see in the footage, in a plastic box, actually, where they're kept every day because they're very dangerous criminals. And they're hearing all of this said about them, and it was very painful for them to be accused of hatred. They're punks. They're not hateful people. And just hearing that kind of lie over and over again. And the only voice of sanity in that entire trial were their three closing statements, which are all remarkable. They're all in the book in their entirety. And they're all amazing.
And we're going to play that in just a second. We don't really have time in the rest of, you know, this part of the discussion to go into the way that this was more of a show trial and then the sentences they got. And then as well, and maybe in the question period, we can bring some of it up, was the experiences of Maria and Nadia in the penal colony, where you actually were able to go with her husband and go visit her in near Perm, wasn't it?
It was in Mordovia.
Okay, Mordovia. And that, in any case, but the final statements, and I think this, the whole trial proceeding as you read it, when you read the book, will seem very strange to a Westerner. It's not exactly the way that you see the role of a judge or the defense lawyers or the prosecution. Or, in fact, because as the women said, this was the only place where you could have a political conversation. Later on, they say that in the court.
Yeah, no, sure. I say that.
And you say it, but right. Okay. So, but maybe we should go, and you can look at the final clip, the one that you started before, and then we can go back and just talk about that before we go to court.
Right.
It's really quite beautiful, and of course, after that, they are sentenced later to very harsh time in a penal colony.
Right.
We only have 20 minutes for questions. Should we open it up and then see what we can come back? Of course, I just want to let you know that one of the excellent things is a very beautifully written book, but the entire statements are reproduced here. This is only a very short part of it. And really, the clarity that you see from their experience of those 9 days, as you say, and then later on, comes through, and they really, as you also say, use it as a form of continued performance in a way. It becomes part of their performance.
Right.
All right, well, let me get an indication of how many questions we're going to have. And, okay, all right.
Actually, I was very interested in the place of religion in Russian life, because from what I had understood under the Soviet Union, there was not a very active church. So since so much of this is church-centered, and you mentioned the use of the Russian Orthodox Church and that they chose the church, could you talk a little bit more about the place of Russian Orthodoxy in Russian culture?
It's yeah. I mean, that's exactly the right way to phrase the question. Is it's the place of the church in Russian culture, because it's not the role of belief in God, but it's traditionally the Russian Orthodox Church has always served at the pleasure of the Tsar, and then later the other dictators who came. It was always a state church. And in the Soviet period, a lot of the physical churches were destroyed. A lot of the monasteries were destroyed or repurposed. And most clergy weren't allowed to practice. But the ones who were worked for the KGB. And in times of crisis, the government always relied on the church. And for example, during World War II, when Stalin mounted his defense effort, he very much conscribed the church into the mobilization effort. And for a while, there were even chaplains in the Red Army. And basically, the same thing has happened over the last few years in Russia. It's very interesting that there's I'm not a big fan of opinion polls, but sometimes, especially in an authoritarian society, they're just very problematic. But sometimes they show things, and there's a very interesting poll that shows that a vast majority of Russians identify as Russian Orthodox, but do not believe in God. So it's the seat of identity for a lot of people, and it is something that's abstract enough, it's enough of a blank slate to appeal to for any political purpose. It's being used now. It was used against Pussy Riot. It's been used very much in the anti-gay campaign, and it's sort of the new Russian national idea. Is that Russia? It will be the traditional values capital of the world, and this is the torch that the Russian Orthodox Church carries. It has very little to do with the actual religion.
More questions? Yeah, right there.
Getting back to opinion polls, I've read more than once that opinion polls in Russia show a very high approval rating for Putin up in around the 70%, 75% area. Can you comment on what you think about the credibility of those a little bit more? And also, what's your sense of the Russian people's feelings about the incursion into the Ukraine, or at least into the Crimean area, if that's not getting too far afield?
No, that's not too far afield at all. I was hoping we would get to that. Opinion polling in authoritarian countries is fraught. I mean, there are several very good books out on the problem of measuring opinion in a country where opinion is not freely expressed or even formed. So that's a big problem. If we look at some of the polls in Russia there and some other indicators, it hasn't been all smooth sailing for Putin. And in fact, at his lowest point, he was at his lowest point actually at the time of this protest and the election on March 4th, 2012. He claimed to get 63% of the vote. He, in fact, got around 50% of the vote. Sounds pretty good, right? Unless you consider the fact that there was nobody else on the ballot. there were four names on the ballot that were put there with Putin's permission, and none of them campaigned. So that means there was about 50% vote for Putin and 50% protest vote in a rigged election. That is pretty remarkable. That is not a high level of support at all. Support for him has rebounded. It rebounded last week with the invasion of Ukraine. It took him 2 years to recover. So that, you know, the whole crackdown, the whole anti-gay campaign, the whole traditional values campaign has helped in the mobilization effort, but it didn't help his ratings until he invaded Ukraine. And that, I think, answers both parts of your question.
There's a question in the back. Oh, sorry.
Hi. I know that you're back living in New York now, but when you were still in Moscow, I know you were active with Triangle, the queer rights organization. Can you tell me what's happening with Triangle? Have they been just effectively outlawed now, or is there still, I would imagine, still an underground queer rights movement?
Well, Triangle existed in the 90s. It's been a while. But the Triangle was sort of an expression of this belief that we had, and this was true not just of gay people, as we called ourselves at the time, but also feminists and lots of other people who thought that we could just, like, after the Soviet Union collapsed, we would have all the normal movements like every country should have, and they would just happen. Well, they didn't just happen, because you can't have an LGBT or queer movement until you have community and identity. So actually, all of that stuff sort of died down in the 90s, and something much more organic began happening a few years ago. Community-building organizations showed up. There are several of them in existence in St. Petersburg and in Moscow and in smaller cities. They haven't been outlawed, but they're obviously very much under attack. The problem that they have faced is that, you know, community-building organizations are probably the worst positioned to fight a political battle. I mean, they're very community oriented. They weren't even media consumers until this all started happening, and they've been thrust into politics. They've held up remarkably well. They've certainly gotten a lot more support, both from LGBT people in Russia and from the small liberal intelligentsia community in Russia than they ever had before. That's the silver lining of the whole anti-gay campaign, and they're trying to fight. But, you know, most of the phone calls that the LGBT network is getting, which is the largest Russian LGBT organization, most of the calls they're getting is from people asking how to get out of the country.
More questions? We've got right here.
How concerned are you about the freedom of the members of Pussy Riot in the future? In particular, do you think they could be rearrested now that the Olympics are over? Putin's not trying to appeal so much to the rest, and thanks to the Crimean situation, relations are getting bad anyway.
Yeah. They're definitely a target. They're at risk of being rearrested, and then they're at risk of physical harm. And I'm more concerned about physical harm at this point. They have been getting attacked weekly I'm sure you've all seen the video of them getting horsewhipped in Sochi. More recently, last week in Nizhny Novgorod, they were attacked by some nationalist activists apparently affiliated with the secret police in Nizhny Novgorod. They sprayed them with a green disinfectant, and they lobbed a metal jar of this disinfectant at Maria's head, and she had to get stitches. And they sprayed Nadia's eyes with some kind of acid. This is really scary stuff. I mean, they're coming to physical harm on a regular basis.
Right over here.
This is kind of a follow-up of that last question, but what is the legacy and the impact of artist movements in Russia right now? And will this continue? Will other people step forward to take the place? I mean, are people fearful now, or what's going to happen?
Russia is in the midst of an extreme political crackdown. It began 2 years ago with the arrest of Pussy Riot. I mean, that's a very significant event. Since then, many people have been arrested for protests. There's also been a series of laws passed, changing the rules of public assembly, changing the laws governing non-governmental organizations that basically allow the authorities to paralyze their work for months at a time or to shut them down summarily, and that has happened on a number of occasions. So the cost of protest and the cost of civic work are extremely high. What's happening in the last couple of weeks since the war effort began is the final attack on independent media. I mean, the only independent television channel in the country will probably shut down in the next week or two. They've already been dropped to 80% of their satellite and cable providers. The big news agency, the big independent news agency, Lenta.ru, was basically handed over to the state today. And what happened today was actually, it's amazing, it's privately owned. And the editor found out this morning that she was fired. A Kremlin hand was appointed in her place. And just before we went on stage, the reason I was staring at my phone so intently was because if you logged onto Lenta.ru a couple hours ago, all the news items were linked to state news agency items. So it was literally handed over to the Kremlin, the largest privately owned news resource in the country.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you so much. In the context of historical Russia, this gigantic country that's had authoritarian rule for hundreds of years and then very strict communist rule, a Russian friend of mine said to me in Moscow about 10 years ago, Russian people, we've never had democracy. We've never had freedom. We don't know how to do this yet. And it's tragic to see this dictatorial authority and state returning. But if you could just talk a little bit about, in the context of Russian history, how is it worse now? And where do you see hope for Russians finding their voice?
How is it worse now than when?
Then, anytime. Do you think it's worse now? I mean, you left, so what's...
Well, yeah, it's worse than last year. Last year I could still live there. It's been a downhill slide for 14 years, almost 15 years since Putin came to power. That's a long time to be shutting down democracy. It was a slow process at first, and it has speeded up literally in the last 2 weeks. I mean, I can't stress this enough. What has happened since the invasion of Ukraine has been an all-out effort to isolate Russia from the rest of the world and shut down the last vestiges of public space and free speech in the country. I've always been a little suspicious of the argument that, look, Russia has never had democracy. Well, you know, with the exception of the countries of the New World, most countries had never had democracy until they had democracy. At the same time, I've been thinking recently that there may be something very specific and very tragic to the abuse that Russian society has suffered for so long. And I think that societies need to recover from abuse very much the same way that people need to recover from abuse. And that requires help and intervention and treatment and all sorts of things that Russians didn't get in the 90s. And it shouldn't be a surprise that Russia has gone back to its abuser. That's what abuse victims usually do.
So the two-part question. First, is your book, did you also write it in Russian or in Cyrillic? And is it and is it available in Russia? Like, what would...
Right no. Now?
Okay.
No.
And
next
when
part.
You talked about the university, I had thought that there were four equal buildings on each side of Moscow, one of which was the university. So when you said that the university floor was the highest overlooking that three...
Yeah, no, there are actually seven similar high-rises in Moscow, but the one that houses Moscow University is on the tallest hill in Moscow, so it's the highest elevation in the city.
Do we have more? Yes.
Hi, thank you. I want to thank you for your work and for writing
thank you.
That book. I was particularly struck by the passages that describe life in the penal colonies, and I'm wondering, as a journalist who worked in Russia, how often do you get to really get a first-hand report of what goes on in places like that?
Right. I did a fair amount of reporting from penal colonies in the 90s. And in fact, I did some work in penal colonies in the early 90s when Russia repealed its sodomy law. I actually ran a project getting people out of prison after the law was repealed. So I had some familiarity with it. But then as I sort of did other work and access to penal colonies became more and more restricted in the 2000s. I hadn't been there in years, and I was shocked, absolutely shocked by what I found. It was, and what Nadia and Maria have described so eloquently, and what some of the people who had served time in the same colonies whom I interviewed for the book described somewhat less willingly and eloquently, in part because it's so humiliating that women don't want to talk about it. It's dehumanizing. It is particularly humiliating to women because so much of what they face is centered around personal hygiene. And nobody wants to talk about that. But that's one of the main tools of control and of turning the inmate into a body that is just moved between the factory and the dorm, which is a phrase from Maria. But it's also an economic system, and this is something that Maria and Nadia have been very eloquent about since they got out. It's an economic system that's built on slave labor. It is very much a part of the larger corruption system of the state that requires more and more output because the greed at the top just continues growing. And Nadia experienced that firsthand. I mean, the workday just kept getting longer. First, it was very long, 13 hours, but then it was even longer, 15 and, 4, and 16 and 17 hours. And then she was sleeping 2 hours a night, and there were no days off.
And we have one last question.
We had a representative from Riot Girl here allowed not too long ago, as well as Exene Cervenka of X. And I was wondering if Pussy Riot had heard any of their music or was influenced by them at all. I know they fall in line with that practice. And then secondarily, how do they make a living? How do they support themselves before they got arrested and now? How do they do that?
I don't actually know. I mean, I assume that they heard Riot Girl groups because they obviously referenced Riot Girls in the Riot Girl movement in the way that they named themselves. They certainly listened to a fair amount of various kinds of punk music and lifted some of it. As far as how they support themselves, well, I mean, they're all different people. Some of them were college students who were also working. Some of them were living at home. like Maria, was living at home and going to college. And some of them had jobs, like there was a musician who was very much involved, who actually made a good living as a computer programmer. And some of them mostly shoplifted and lived in squats. So there are all sorts of different people.
Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time, but I want to thank you for your questions. You managed to touch on many of the areas I hoped that we would have more time to explore, and there's so much more in the book. Masha Gessen will be signing outside. I'd also like to ask all of you to think about supporting this program that brings these kinds of writers to Los Angeles. Donations, of course, I'm sure, you know, if you talk to Louise Steinman outside, you can figure out a way to handle that. Look forward to Masha's new work. She's writing on the Tsarnaev brothers and the Boston Massacre. When do you expect that that will, the Boston Marathon,
don't
rather?
Ask that question.
You don't know. All right. But you can look forward to that. And I want to thank you so much for coming to Los Angeles
thank
today.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.